young lad. We haven't seen that much of him. He's been in and out of City. And there you're going, it's an absolute snip.
Now you see why. You're one of those.
Yeah, one of those.
Still questioning it, but here he is.
You have to be able to admit it.
Oh, Renee and Stephen, thank you so much for coming on. Don't forget, you can get more of the Weekend's Games with Five Lives Football Daily Podcast on BBC Sounds coming up to 8 o'clock.
The voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Breakfast.
Morning, everyone. Let's take you through the main news headlines this morning then. Authorities in Lebanon think a million people have already been displaced by the conflict between Hezbollah and Israel. There have been more Israeli strikes overnight. Three leaders of a separate Palestinian militant group have been killed in Beirut. Richard Hecht is a former IDF spokesperson and current reservist, and he told Five Live Breakfast how the conflict could end.
It's been going on for a year and we just have to stop this thing from happening. I mean, it's very painful, it's very traumatic for the people of Lebanon, for the Palestinian people, but we're going to go all the way. We have no alternative. All the way is Hezbollah leaves the border, stops firing, goes beyond the Litani lever, it would be over. That simple.
The UK economy grew by 0.5% in the second quarter of the year, according to the latest figures from the Office for National Statistics. That's been revised down from an initial estimate of 0.6%.
The BBC has discovered McDonald's failed to stop the exploitation of nine men who'd been trafficked to the UK from the Czech Republic and forced to work in one of its branches. They were brought here by a Czech criminal gang who faced trial earlier this year. The former Prime Minister Theresa May leads the Global Commission on Modern Slavery.
The case has raised some shocking questions about the approach being taken by some big companies. They need to look at their supply chains, they need to look at their processes. When people are going in to buy that burger at McDonald's, they want to have confidence that the people working there are not being effectively in slavery through forced labour.
McDonald's and its franchisees say they are trying to detect potential risks and are committed to helping every worker spot warning signs.
Britain's last coal-fired power station closes at midnight when operations end at Ratcliffe-on-Soar in Nottinghamshire. The UK will become the world's first major economy to stop using coal to generate electricity.
Traditional steelmaking, meanwhile, comes to an end in South Wales later. Tata Steel in Port Talbot is going to turn off its coal-powered blast furnace for the last time. Thousands of jobs will be lost at the plant. Our Wales business correspondent Hugh Thomas has more.
Tata throughout this keen to say all the time, look, we are investing in a new way of making steel. But today, this is a significant moment, not just because it ends that traditional steel making technology, but also signals the start of a big wave of redundancies on that site as well.
And tributes are being paid to Kris Kristofferson, who's died at the age of 88. His family described him as a peacenik, a revolutionary, an actor, a superstar, a sex symbol and a family man. He passed away peacefully at his home in Hawaii.
What a tribute, isn't it?
Yes.
I think we'd all be happy with that at the end of our days. Right, let's get the sport. Here's Shoujo. What's happening, Shoujo?
Good morning. The Manchester United manager, Erik ten Hag, says, I think we will get better. We need some time. We are all on one page. The ownership, the leadership group, the staff and the players group as well. He was speaking after United lost 3-0 at home to Tottenham in the Premier League. Australia won the fifth and deciding ODI against England by 49 runs in Bristol by the DLS method in a rain-affected match. That's despite England's Ben Duckett scoring a century. Australia won that series 3-2. And in women's rugby union, defending WXV1 champions England thrashed the USA 61-21. While there was a sensational result in that tournament overnight in Vancouver as Ireland beat the world champions New Zealand in the final minute, it finished 29-27 to Ireland.
Thank you, Shoujo. Helen's got your weather for you this morning.
Jeanette, Rachel, good morning to you. Hello there. It's wet out there for quite a number of areas this morning. Scotland, it's showers, so there'll be quite a bit of dry weather for both the west and the east, and those showers will hopefully ease away. The best of the sunshine, though, will be across northern Scotland and the Northern Isles. 14 degrees here, but 12 or 13 in the rain. But Northern Ireland, we've got a little bit of rain in the east, a little bit of rain in the west, some dry weather in between. It's just going to generally be cloudy today with some rain at times. 12 or 13 the highs. The heaviest rain, the most problem-causing rain is across northern England, North Wales, into East Anglia, parts of the Midlands and the South East, and it's slow-moving. So another 20 to 40 millimetres, if not more than that, through the day ahead. The ground's already saturated. There are over 50 flood warnings in force as well in England to consider. And even once it's brightening up to the south of that, South Wales, southern England, there are showers to come today and a blustery wind for all. In fact, close to gale near the English coast, the South England English coast, that is. So we might get 16 or 17 in the sunshine, but tempered by the feel of it with that wind. 12 or 13 in the rain clearly is going to cause further flood problems and travel problems.
And what about the roads, Orna?
Yes, it is translating that way, unfortunately. So the M6 is taking longer than usual, all the way through the West Midlands, down from Turn at Walsall to the M5, but taking about 50 minutes now, so it has reduced. So it's turning a corner. The M1 Northern Ireland, County Antrim, Junction 6 at Lisburn, an accident blocking a lane northbound. M55 eastbound towards the M6, an accident in one lane at Forward at Junction 1. M60Q still there clockwise, 23 Ashton under Lyme. Everything at a stand now to clear an accident off the road. The M62 in West Yorkshire, westbound at Tingley 28, a breakdown causing long queues. M6 in Cheshire, a breakdown at 18 to 19, Knutsford, northbound, it's very slow. M4 eastbound towards London, Junction 5 at Langley, an accident in one lane. And the A1M still closed at Hartford, Junction 4, northbound. Orna Merchant, 5 Live Travel.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Breakfast.
Good morning, everyone. It's 5 minutes past eight. If you're just switching on now and wondering what on earth we've been talking about for the last couple of hours, where have you been? Well, it's Jeanette Kwotche and Rachel Burden here with you this morning. Our top story, those Israeli strikes on Lebanon and Yemen. We'll talk about those in just a moment with our international editor, Jeremy Bowen.
We've also been focusing on the Conservative Party conference as well this morning and comments from the leadership hopeful, Kemi Badenoch, which have dominated the headlines today. She said maternity pay has gone too far and it's affecting businesses, but not everyone agrees.
We're not talking about huge sums here. And it's absolutely bonkers to say that that's not why women are taking maternity leave, or even worse, that that's why people aren't starting businesses.
And that's Michelle Kennedy from an online community for mums and mums-to-be called Peanut. Loads of you getting in touch about this. Nikki will be talking about it from 9 o'clock this morning.
Mm-hmm. 85058 if you have thoughts on it. And we've also been speaking about whether you've had the best or worst weekend than Erik ten Hag. And that's after Manchester United lost 3-0 to Spurs yesterday at home. We spoke to a happy Tottenham fan, Chris, a bit earlier.
We've scored more goals at Old Trafford this season than Manchester United have.
Wow. So, and this is a serious text from John Aneath, but I think it's fair. So he says, I've just driven past Port Talbot Steelworks and I suspect they have had a worse time than Ten Hag, all those job losses there as a result of the steelworks closing. I'm sure his future payoff will be more than all the workers combined. It's not the funny ha-ha text you were looking for, but I'm annoyed this morning that this isn't big news for you. Just a brief mention in the headlines, but that is reflective of how much focus is given to Wales generally, says John Aneath. He says, roll on independence. That's what John says. Have you had a worse weekend than Erik ten Hag? In a serious way or a less serious way? 85058. You can WhatsApp us on 08085909693.
But let's go back to our top story in the news bulletin, the situation in the Middle East, where the conflict between Israel and Iran's allies seems to be spreading rapidly. Israel attacked targets of the Houthi regime in Yemen yesterday. Ports, power stations and fuel tanks were hit, killing at least 4 people and wounding 33.
Now, over the weekend, Israel has kept up its bombardments of targets in Lebanon after assassinating Hezbollah's leader Hassan Nasrallah in Beirut on Friday. An apartment building has been hit in Beirut city centre overnight in what appears to be the first Israeli airstrike on the capital in an area outside Hezbollah control.
Yeah, well, let's talk to our international editor, Jeremy Bowen. Jeremy, good morning. What appears to be the latest?
Well, what's going on is that Israel is continuing its onslaught on its enemies. It seems to be in a mood to really take care of business in the region, because as well as in Lebanon, as well as hitting Hezbollah, it's also hit Palestinian groups. The Hamas leader has been killed, reportedly, along with his family. Other Palestinian factions have been attacked by the Israelis, plus they did that raid in Yemen on a very important port. The worry that Israel's allies, in fact, have, led by the United States, who continue to say there needs to be a ceasefire and a diplomatic solution, and Israel, of course, is completely rejecting that idea. I mean, their worry is that the instability and unpredictability in the region now makes it way more dangerous. And there are also big question marks about how, when, and if Iran might respond. And they may not respond straight away, but they may respond at a time when they think they're more likely to make an impact than right now.
Well, the impact is so far-reaching, isn't it? And I do want to ask you about Yemen in particular being attacked and why that is the case.
Well, the group that's in charge in Yemen, called the Houthis, they are allies of Iran, and Iran has furnished them with various ballistic missiles as well as drones, where from, you know, periodically they fire them at Israel. They also attack shipping in the Red Sea, international shipping there. And so they are seen very much as a participant in the war, and that's actually how they see themselves. They say that they are attacking to support Hamas in Gaza. So you're seeing links between these different, if you like, lots of links between the different fires that are burning around the region. And the worry of lots of observers is that it might all become one big fire.
Why do you think it is that Israel are not paying heed to the calls for de-escalation of this in terms of where it could go to?
Because they think they know better. They are looking at the results of what they've done in the last couple of weeks, and they have, without a shadow of a doubt, they have delivered absolutely devastating blows to Hezbollah, which had become a really significant enemy of theirs, which in the past had humiliated the Israeli army, had forced them to concede, had claimed victories against them. And, you know, one big difference with the war against Hamas in Gaza is that that was unexpected for Israel, and they're still fighting it, and they haven't beaten Hamas yet. They have been planning a war with Hezbollah since the last one ended in 2006, and they've clearly thoroughly either penetrated the organization or picked up so much digital intelligence that they know where people are and they can kill them. However, the organization of Hezbollah is big. It's lost a lot of its leaders, but it has thousands of battle-hardened fighters who've had a lot of experience fighting in Syria and also fighting against the Israelis in previous wars. And they still presumably have quite a large number of weapons. Mm. So if Israel decides that it wants to perhaps to invade South Lebanon, which is being discussed and is probably quite likely, then there are people in and around Hezbollah who say, well, look, that's going to help us and negate the advantages they have. It's different if it's a fight on the ground. We'll see.
Earlier we spoke to a journalist that's on the ground in Beirut, a PBS journalist, and was speaking about the fact that Beirut city centre has been hit overnight. That takes it up another notch, doesn't it, when you're hitting such densely populated areas like the city centre?
Yeah, because what the message the Israelis are repeatedly saying from the Prime Minister downwards is that it doesn't matter where you are. If you're our enemy and we want to kill you, we will kill you. And of course, the way that they, because these are built up areas, they may go after specific individuals, but that generally means that the family gets killed, maybe the neighbors get killed too. So that's why the casualty levels have been going up so rapidly. The death levels have been going up so rapidly in Lebanon, and in, you know, the course of about just over a week, Israel has killed nearly as many people as they killed in 34 days of war in Lebanon with Hezbollah in 2006.
Has Netanyahu given any indication of what it is that he wants from this, or when he sees that this may subside? I don't know. Is there any way to kind of look to how this might play out?
Yeah, the Israelis say that, first of all, what they need to do is get back to their homes, these 60,000-plus people who have been evacuated for a year from the border areas with Lebanon, because Israel was worried they evacuated them, because, first of all, they were worried there'd be a cross-border raid like Hamas did out of Gaza, and also because they were being hit by rockets and artillery being fired out of Lebanon. So the thing is that killing Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, killing the military leadership, bombing their headquarters in Beirut, that does not bring it any closer to getting those people back. Because despite the hits it's taken, which, as I say, are very severe and massively weakening for Hezbollah, they are still managing to fire rockets into Israel. And of course, with a war going on like that, no civilian is going to want to go back. And of course, the government is not going to risk allowing them to go back. So actually, if that is a major objective of the Israelis, to have a safe, quiet border with Lebanon, and actually, the escalation has probably made it even more dangerous.
Jeremy, as always, thank you. That's our international editor, Jeremy Bowen.
Well, we can talk now to Professor Paul Moorcraft, who's a former UK Ministry of Defence analyst. His new book, Israel's Forever War, looks at the background to the current conflict. Good morning to you, Paul.
Good morning. You know, it's a hard act to follow. Jeremy's one of the best commentators on the Middle East. He's a fellow Welshman, a fellow Cardiffian. And he's what he said, I pretty much agree with.
Well, I was just going to ask you, actually, that. Yeah, I know. I was just going to ask you whether you agree with his assessment, actually, that this particular campaign in Lebanon, whether that has only made the situation more precarious for people in northern Israel. So you agree with that, do you?
I agree with everything he said, but I'd like to add one or two things.
Sure.
First of all, everybody in the area, actually probably the world, is waiting for Godot. They're waiting for the American presidential results, particularly obviously Ukraine, Russia, and the war is connected. The two wars are connected, not least because of the Iranian involvement. But I think that Netanyahu, who I've interviewed three or four times, is going for broke in this lame duck period. He's saying, right, the because he's ignored the president, U.S. president, because as Jeremy said, they have been preparing since 2006, the Israelis, for this war in Lebanon, whereas Hamas from Gaza caught the Israelis by surprise. The crucial difference is that Hamas was a failure, not of military intelligence, the IDF military intelligence. They were in charge there. And it was misogynistic military intelligence officers because they ignored all the warnings from the female spotters, watchers. So it was a failure, not by Mossad. Mossad had been fully involved in Lebanon. They are very good, probably the best in the world. So this has restored not only the intelligence deterrence of Israel, but also Bibi Netanyahu is now back on. You know, he's Mr. Security again. He's very popular war in Israel. He's got more people joining him in parliament. So he has restored his image as well as restoring Israeli deterrence. But I agree with what Jeremy said. This is lots of different fires. They may all unite into a major, major war.
Well, we spoke to...
sure about the land invasion.
I was just going to put to you the point that was made by a guest we spoke to after 7 o'clock, who's a former IDF spokesperson, current reservist, who said, Lebanon, if Hezbollah just agree with that 1701 UN resolution, which would see them push back from the border with northern Israel, then everything stops and we'd be not fine. But he said, look, that particular campaign would come to an end. Is it as simple as that?
I wish it were, because obviously if you're going to go back, you need a ceasefire in Gaza first. And the hostages are still there. That's why Netanyahu's reputation will still be besmirched. I don't think I lived on that board for some time in Baram, right on the board, very beautiful looking down in Lebanon. But the war is going to go on and on, because if there's a land invasion, the headlines of the Times today showed lots of pictures of Merkava 4 tanks waiting to go in. I think it's going to be a massive mistake. Israel is doing very well with air power. They always say that air power is alone. It's like having an affair, that it's you get gratification without commitment. And you need boots on the ground. I'm not sure I agree, because the Israeli Air Force, and because it's got fabulous, Mossad has got fabulous intelligence, human it's called, human intelligence, as well as all the signals intelligence. That's what Hezbollah wants, is to fight the Israelis on the ground. Despite their decapitation and their attacks, they are still formidable troops. As Jeremy said, lots of experience in Syria. They are ready to fight the Israelis, and that removes the air power advantage.
The other question I have
Israel
is...
Israel will be wrong to invade. They may well do it because they make mistakes.
Yeah, and the other question is, I just wonder how many different fronts the Israeli military can successfully fight on if they're also targeting Yemen. They've got the war in Gaza going on. They're looking at militias in Syria and Iraq as well. Can they manage it all? And equally, just how degraded are like Hezbollah and the other Iran-backed militias now as a result of this?
You'd ask how degraded the Israeli Defense Force is. Because it's largely a reserve army, it's a professional corps, a very good army. And they are remoralized after the success in Lebanon. I would suggest that there are lots more things that could happen. I've, in the intelligence circles, there's talk about the Turks. If Britain's troops, they just put 700 in Cyprus, if Britain uses Cyprus as an unsinkable aircraft carrier, then it's been hinted that the Turks might go back into, or the Turkish army in numbers might go back into northern Cyprus, because Turkey's got, although it's a NATO member, it's got an awkward relationship. But I would argue that the biggest threat, following your point, is that there could be a third intifada in the West Bank. And although the Israelis, the IDF and special forces have gone in, particularly in the center of Jenin, and I spent quite a lot of time in Jenin, it is the center of resistance in the West Bank. So there could be a third intifada. And everybody knows, even the most basic armchair general knows, that you can't fight on all these fronts, especially the Israeli. Nobody mentions this, but the Israeli economy is strained because so many reservists are called up. So I don't know what's going to happen. There could be a major international war, but it partly depends on whether the IDF makes the big mistake of a land invasion of Lebanon.
Well, we
but
wait.
You don't know what the other point is. Iran, the Americans have very little influence, clearly, until there's a change of president. But the Americans were in the first couple of days. In my book, there's a section which says that within the first couple of hours, the Israeli Air Force went in to attack Hezbollah right at the start, as soon as Hamas attacked on October the 7th. But President Biden intervened to stop Netanyahu. At that stage, the Israelis were listening to the all-powerful ally. So they have wanted to do this. Netanyahu has wanted to remove Hezbollah. He also doesn't believe in the two-state solution at all. As long as he's in power, there won't be a two-state solution. And final point, if I may, Iran is as influential as America. Iran wants to keep some missiles in Hezbollah's control. They pull most of the strings. They want to keep some precise weapons there, the best ballistic missiles, as a deterrent, not so much against Israel, but against America.
Yeah. Okay. Look, wow, that is a lot to get your head around of a Monday morning, but I appreciate your expertise and your experience in this region as well. Thanks very much for talking to us. Professor Paul Moorcroft, he's written a book, Israel's Forever War, former UK Military of Defence analyst. It's 8:22.
On BBC iPlayer.
He's our dog.
We made a mistake.
Please, not anymore. He's not, mate. Wake up.
The new series of Colin from Accounts.
Do we even need a pet?
We've got other stuff in common.
Do we?
What is your favourite kind of music?
Bubble grunge.
What is that?
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
Right, let's talk cricket now at 8:23 here on Five Live Breakfast. England's cricketers falling short in their one-day series against Australia. They had pulled back the series to 2-2. They then posted 309 thanks to another century from Ben Duckett and captain Harry Brook. He made 72. But the rain intervened. Australia were 165 for 2. That meant that the Aussies went ahead on the Duckworth-Lewis-Stern method. So they ended up winning the whole series 3-2. How frustrating. What can the England team learn from this series defeat? Here's their interim ODI coach, Marcus Truscothick.
Lots of positives to take. I think we've seen batters at the top of the order. Obviously, Ben Duckett, Will Jacks, have impact on games, you know, playing in the way that they did. Harry Brook, again, has had more opportunity to, you know, to bat in the 50-over environment while also being captain is obviously a huge positive. Jofra is another positive. See how much more workload we've got into him.
Well, let's speak to the former England batsman Nick Compton. Morning, Nick.
Good morning.
They were nearly down and out in this series. So how much credit do you give them for pulling themselves back and actually having something to play for in the final match?
Yeah, I think it was good effort, wasn't it? A very young team, as Marcus alluded to, and players that they're starting to mould into trying to see what the future holds for England's one-day team. Look, they've had a lot of success, haven't they, for the last sort of 4 or 5 years, and it's always going to be a period of rebuilding and finding that that's a cohesive unit. I mean, they showed their inexperience at times, but they also showed some of the excitement and exuberance of youth that we've come to see in English cricket.
Well, you saw that in that innings yesterday, didn't you? Rampant with the bat at the start, getting to 202 for two inside the first part of the match, but then all out for 309. So what was going on there?
Yeah, similar to the first game at Trent Bridge. You know, no real rock of stability, probably, you know, missing out on the likes of Joe Root and Joss Butler and even Ben Stokes if he gets called back into the one-day fold. So, yes, weren't able to sort of really capitalise on those strong positions, and that ultimately led to their series defeat against, you know, a more experienced Australian team, the world champions. So no mean feat. To get back to 2-all, I thought was excellent. I thought Harry Brook stood up and played some of the cricket that we know he can. He's an exciting young player. He's got that sort of air of Kevin Peterson about him, hasn't he? He's got the ability to do things and the X factor that we've come to see from him in the test format. So that was exciting. And a number of other players stood up and put their hands up too. I think Jofra Archer for me is the exciting point, or the real positive. I mean, a man that's been out with injury, we know what he can do, and to see him bowl some of the deliveries at some of the pace that we've seen in the past was very good.
It'd be great to see him back with some consistency. Now, we've been talking about the dark arts of gamesmanship and time wasting, but in relation to football in recent weeks, not in relation to cricket, but it did. There was a bit of this, wasn't there, when there was a possibility of the whole match ending in farcical fashion. England were trying to slow down proceedings and ensure the 20 overs needed for a contest weren't bowled in time, which would have meant no result in the series to be drawn. What did you make of all of that?
Yeah, I look, it's gamesmanship. I'm sure the umpires have got to keep a tabs on that. It's not.
Well, it didn't ideal. Work in the end, did it?
It didn't work in the end. And I think, you know, the sort of common sense prevailed, but and Australia got, you know, their rewards. But yeah, look, it happens. I'm sure they were desperate to draw the series. That would have been a really good draw, wouldn't it, for England? And, you know, but I think they squandered a good position. I think they should have got well in excess of 350, and perhaps they wouldn't have had to delay any time. They might have been speeding up time by then.
And Pakistan to come in a three-match series, test series, actually, this one. Is that here in the UK?
No, it's actually in Pakistan.
Oh, it is. I was going to say, surely not in October. No, what's going on as I look out the window to rainy Salford?
Well, the cricket has been pushed to the margins of the summers, hasn't it?
Yeah.
With the advent of the 100. So, look, no, I think a big series for England. Pakistan, I've actually just been there. I was commentating in the Pakistan-Bangladesh series. I think that there is a time to take on Pakistan in Pakistan and win that series. I think it's now. I think Pakistan are struggling, and I think England's test team will be too strong for them. But it is foreign conditions, and a lot of the young players in that test team, as good as they are, wouldn't have played cricket in Pakistan. So it'll be a new opportunity for them.
Nice to talk to you, Nick. Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you.
Nick Compton, former England batsman there on England's series defeat against Australia in that one-day series. 8:28.
House prices, they've risen at the fastest rate for nearly 2 years, according to figures out this morning. Sean from Wake Up to Money is back with us. Sean.
Hello.
What is happening?
Yeah, so this is Nationwide who do a bit of number crunching based on all of the mortgages that it's lending out. And it saw that in September, there was a bit more activity than there was previously, which we'd discussed. We'd heard from estate agents saying September looks like being the busiest September we've had for a while. It's normally after the summer people start to focus on their long-term life plans again. And actually, it does seem that house prices have been picking up, so up by 3.2%. compared to a year ago, which is that fastest rate for nearly 2 years. And a lot of that down to, you know, interest rates not being as quite as high as they were, but also expectations that they're going to be coming down. people still waiting for some of those more moves down. And the squeeze on incomes that we've seen in recent years easing off for some people, by no means for everybody, but for those that are maybe having a deposit and in a stronger financial situation than others to look for a house, things have got a little bit looser for them and they've been able to make that purchase and push house prices up when you look at what Nationwide are doing at the moment.
But despite that, the economy, it didn't grow as quickly as previously thought. That's what the new data shows, isn't it?
Yeah, are people watching this stuff maybe a little more closely than usual with a budget coming up in a month's time, and we're hearing lots of messages from the government about, you know, what they think the economy's like. And the economy, initially we thought the Office of National Statistics said the economy grew by 0.6% between April and June. They've got a bit more data in now a few months later, and they found that it didn't quite grow by quite as much, 0.5%. So very similar numbers, but all playing into, you know, the size of the economy, how much we're producing, how much we're doing as a nation. And actually car manufacturing in that period was worse than previously thought, so that having a bit of an impact on those numbers.
And what about car companies? There's a warning on their profits this morning.
Yeah, interesting. Alongside that stuff from the Office of National Statistics this morning, Stellantis, which has got plenty of brands. You won't see Stellantis on the front of a car, but you will see the likes of Vauxhall that they own, one of the ton of brands that they have. Stellantis saying this morning its profits won't be as big as previously thought. Aston Martin, which, you know, may not be on the shopping list for many people.
I'll speak for yourself, Sean.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, I've got to choose between a Vauxhall and an Aston Martin soon. But Aston Martin saying that actually they're not going to be making as many cars as they thought. They don't make that many manufacturing, employing people here in the UK, about 6,500, but they're reducing that by 1,000. They say because of weakness in China. Now, that is one country where there are plenty of people who can afford Aston Martins, and that's a big business year. We talk about British luxury brands. Aston Martin's been one of those cashing in on that. But China's problems lately has hit the likes of Aston Martin now.
Okay, well, Sean, thank you as always. 8:31.
Yeah, let's talk to Nikki. What you got coming up at 9, Nikki?
Well, at 9 o'clock, I'll tell you about it in a second, but at 10 o'clock, what a weekend. They used to win everything for so long. They reigned supreme, but it's been a real fall from those heady heights. Well, a new face at the top. Change it. Manchester United? No, Tories disunited. Big week in British politics. Let's discuss where they go at 10 o'clock. One candidate, Kemi Badenoch, has been talking about maternity pay, as you've been saying. And it's a proper conversation, certainly. She said stuff, then she clarified it. Interesting words, though. Maternity pay isn't excessive, she said, of course, clarifying. Then she said, but no mother of three kids thinks that. But we must talk about the burden of excessive business regulation, otherwise we might as well be the Labour Party. Tax comes from people who are working. We're taking from one group of people, giving it to another. Other candidates weaponising her initial comments as they would. But listen, what's been your experience of it as an employee? Did it give you enough support? Perhaps you and your partner on maternity leave right now, or have recently gone back to work after having a baby. It would be great to hear your experience on the nation's phone-in, and business owners as well. What's it like when a member of your staff has a baby? It can be a real challenge. What are the regulations like? Are there too many of them? All that, 9 o'clock, coming up.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Call free 08085 909 693. Text 85058. Text will be charged at your standard message rate.
Message on WhatsApp 08085 909 693.
Visit bbc.co.uk/5liveterms
for our terms of use and privacy notice.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Let's get the latest headlines then. Israel has carried out more strikes against Hezbollah overnight. In Beirut, an apparent Israeli strike is said to have killed three leaders of a separate Palestinian militant group. Authorities in Lebanon say 1 million people have already been displaced by the conflict.
Figures for economic growth have been revised down for the second quarter of the year. Initial estimates suggested GDP rose by 0.6%, but latest figures say it only went up by 0.5%.
A row about maternity pay has dominated the first day of the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham. The leadership candidate, Kemi Badenoch, says she doesn't want to see changes to maternity leave after suggesting hours earlier that it was excessive.
And Britain's last coal-fired power station closes at midnight. When operations end at Ratcliffe-on-Soar in Nottinghamshire, the UK will become the first major economy to stop using coal to generate electricity.
Helen's got your weather for you this morning.
I have indeed, and it's wet out there for quite a few areas today. Showers for Scotland, the best of the sunshine will be in the north, and the Northern Isles 14 here, but where we've got the showers elsewhere in central areas and in the west, we will see temperature more like 12 or 13. Northern Ireland seeing some outbreaks of rain, a lot of cloud as well. It won't be wet all day for all, so there should be some drier interludes, but just 12 or 13 for most. Across England and Wales, we've got sunny spells and scattered showers. South Wales, southwestern parts of England moving into the southeast eventually, but there'll be heavy showers. But the rain stagnates across East Anglia, the North Midlands, Northern England, the North of Wales. These areas under warning again today from 20 to 40 millimetres of rain, but double that over the hills. It's murky with the visibility as well because of all the spray, standing water and the low cloud. Obviously, there's some flooded roads and we have over 50 flood warnings on the rivers as well. So we expect that that may well become more of an issue as we go through the day. So do stay tuned to the forecasts.
Sorry, I've just been reading the story about a guest we're going to speak to before 9 o'clock this morning, George Dowell, who has made it his mission to basically transform his childhood football club, Worthing FC. But what makes this notable is because he's been paralysed from the chest down since the age of 17. And actually, when you read the detail of his story, it's absolutely extraordinary. Oh, so wow. We're going to talk to him before 9 o'clock this morning. Orna, apologies. What have you got to tell us this morning?
Oh, it is. Yes. So all of that weather is translating to the roads, slippy roads out there. People are keeping a distance for safety, and that's why everything looks slow, and it will do on your sat-nav as well. We've only got one rail problem, surprisingly enough, actually. And that's in the West Midlands. It's between Birmingham New Street and Shrewsbury, so buses are running instead. Now, back to the roads. The M60 clockwise, 23 at Ashton under Lyne. I was waiting for an update. Everything was held back. An accident. One lane is still closed. Queues about to 21 at Hollingwood. That's the M60 clockwise. M90 and 5 southbound at Junction 4, Kelty. Piece of metal in the road. One lane blocked. M606, that's heading south in West Yorkshire, 2 to Junction 1, joining the M62 at Chain Bar. An accident is partly blocking the road. The M6 northbound in Cheshire, 18 to 19, one lane still down with the breakdown there. And then the M23 heading south, repairs are going on. 10A Crawley South, it's at the bottom end, one lane closed southbound. M4 towards London, eastbound 14 Hungerford, a vehicle on fire, one lane's closed. And the M25, so still queuing at 12 at the M3, a broken down van, it's left a 20 minute delay anti-clockwise. Orna Merchant, 5 Live Travel.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Breakfast.
Shoujo, as sure as the, was it the day follows the night or the night follows the day, whatever which way you look at it?
Yeah, both.
Erik ten Hag. Wow. Again, he's in the headlines for potentially what his job prospects might look like.
Yeah, I mean, Manchester United 0, Tottenham 3 at Old Trafford in the Premier League. Plenty of television shots around the ground of disillusioned United fans sitting in the rain, head in hands. The back pages this morning are brutal, as you might expect. A sackable offence, damned bad United, Ten Hag out of his depth, just some of them. It is Manchester United's joint worst start in Premier League history, just 7 points from their first 6 matches this season. Asked if he was worried about his future, manager Erik ten Hag said, "No, I'm not thinking about this. I think we all made together this decision to stay together as an ownership and as a leadership group in the summer.
There's always a new day and we will learn from it. And my players are strong characters and they will bounce back. But we have to learn from this situation, from this afternoon, say in 4 days. A defender of the opponent can so travel over the whole pitch without being stopped. So we have to learn from this and quickly."
Well, Chris Sutton was speaking on 606. He thinks maybe tomorrow is not a new day.
Ten Hag now has spent over £500 million, third season. And that's Manchester United. 2 months down the line, 3 months down the line, do you see Ten Hag, he's been there a long time, making a massive improvement? I don't.
Well, that's Sutton and Savage on 6.06. Much more on the latest Football Daily podcast. Also worth mentioning, after that win, Tottenham say they will take the strongest possible action over abhorrent homophobic chanting from their fans at Old Trafford. Tottenham say it was hugely offensive and no way to show support for the team. Liam Delap scored twice for Ipswich as they drew 2-2 with Aston Villa at Portman Road. Rangers squeaked a 1-0 win against Hibs in the Scottish Premiership. In the Women's Super League, there were wins for Manchester City, Manchester United and for Arsenal.
And in rugby union as well, world champions New Zealand women, they've been stunned in a WXV1 opener in Vancouver. What's that about?
Yeah, incredible result overnight for Ireland in Vancouver. They beat New Zealand by 29 points to 27. Ireland levelled the scores with a last-minute try and then popped over the conversion to win. The Black Ferns will look to come back, bounce back against England on Sunday. England started the defence of their WXV1 title with a 9-try victory over the United States, dominated that match. The Red Roses have now won 18 consecutive matches as they look to maximise momentum going into next summer's home World Cup. The England head coach, John Mitchell, particularly impressed with Alex Matthews, who won player of the match in what was her first game as the England captain.
Well, Alex is an outstanding person, outstanding Red Rose. But I think she demonstrates it, you know, like certainly from a playing side of, is through just the fact that she is very consistent and she's hardworking. And I guess she doesn't really ask anything from anyone else.
Cricket, England's comeback in their one-day international series against Australia came to an end yesterday. Ben Duckett had scored a century in England's innings of 309. Australia, though, won that match by 49 runs under the DLS method because of the rain. The tourists take the series 3-2. And Mark Selby's won his first ranking tournament in 18 months. He won the British Open snooker in Cheltenham, beating John Higgins 10-5 in the final.
Thank you, Shoujo. It's 8:40, 5 Live Breakfast. Right, let's get back to the Conservative Party conference, which has begun. It's in Birmingham. And the big talking point today, Kemi Badenoch, one of the candidates to become the next leader of the Conservative Party, has said she doesn't want any changes to maternity pay, although she seemed to suggest in an interview yesterday that it was excessive. This was a conversation she had on Times Radio, where she appeared to suggest maternity pay had gone too far. Have a listen.
Do you think we've got the right level of maternity pay at the moment?
So maternity pay varies depending on who you work for, but it is a function where it's statutory maternity pay. It is a function of tax. Tax comes from people who are working. We're taking from one group of people and giving to another. This, in my view, is excessive. Businesses are closing. Businesses are not starting in the UK because they say that the burden of regulation is too high.
So maternity pay is excessive.
I think it's gone too far the other way in terms of general business regulation.
Later, though, she seemed to clarify things, saying she didn't think it needs changing, that her views were misrepresented. And now the conference continues today, as I say, in Birmingham, the first since the Conservatives' election defeat in July. All four leadership contenders, Kemi Badenoch, Robert Jenrick, James Cleverly and Tom Tugendhat, are trying to win support before the next round of voting by MPs. So let's talk to a couple of members at the conference. Zach Wagman, Conservative councillor for Stanmore, and Sara Ghezdari, formerly Conservative candidate for Richmond Park and North Kingston. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Can I ask you, first of all, what you made of the remarks by Kemi Badenoch? And do you think perhaps she was just a bit clumsy with her words, or was there some other message she was trying to get across here, Sara?
Well, as she clarified, I think it was just she was misunderstood, honestly. As a woman, as a mum of two, I think maternity pay is absolutely crucial. And I think it's a special moment, and women and men, for that matters, should have the opportunity to enjoy it, especially at the beginning.
Yeah, the line's a little bit wobbly there. Let me see if I can fix that while we have a chat to Zach. Zach, this is the line for me that Kemi Badenoch came out with yesterday that I just feel needs a bit of attention. She said, "We need to have more personal responsibility. There was a time when there wasn't any maternity pay and people were having more babies." What do you think she's trying to say here?
Look, I don't know what Kemi was trying to say in that moment. I think she's clarified it quite clearly since then that she doesn't want to see any changes to maternity pay. I don't think it's unreasonable that leadership contenders, senior politicians should be thinking about where we spend tax revenue. And, you know, it's quite right that everything's considered, but I don't think, you know, from her clarification, I don't think she's made out that she does want to change anything.
So, okay, let's move it on from there. And actually, it's probably worth saying that neither of you is backing Badenoch to be leader anyway. Why not, Sara? Who's your first choice?
Well, Rachel, can I just first start saying that we have seen lately that Keir Starmer has spent the first months of his government breaking the promises he made at the last election and demonstrating how ineffective and self-serving this Labour government will be. His focus has been on creating jobs for his friends, attacking families, and quite frankly, delivering the biggest vindictive policies in British politics. I think as a result of that, people have lost faith in British politics.
Yeah, I mean, the question I asked was who you're backing and why. So I wonder if you can answer that
backing,
one.
Yes, I'm backing Tom Tugendhat. And the reason why I'm backing Tom Tugendhat is because I think Tom is not going to treat politics as a game, like he didn't treat war as a game. He will make the Conservative Party a serious party again, and he will make the right choices. And if we make the right choices as members, we're not going to just choose the next leader, but the next Conservative Prime Minister.
OK, who do you think the next Conservative Prime Minister could or should be, Zach?
I think that the next Conservative leader and Prime Minister should be James Cleverly. I think over his time in Conservative politics as an activist, as a member of the London Assembly and his time in government, he's always been someone that delivers and someone that's been loyal to the party. He's always been someone that puts the party first and the country first. And you can see that in his track record of delivery. I think that's what we need to do to win the next election. As Sara mentioned, this government is doing such a poor job already. We need to be ready to unite our party, put forward Conservative policies and win. And I think James is the person to do that.
And there will be, or there have been certainly commentators who said that they don't feel that there has been a raw enough reflection on why the Conservatives were hammered so significantly at the last general election. It's easy, and I understand why, Sara, you want to go on the attack with Keir Starmer. It feels like quite an easy, simple target at the moment. But do you feel that there's been a sort of genuine self-reflection to understand why the electorate so roundly rejected the Conservatives last time round?
I think it has. We have, and which is the reason why we're taking the right amount of time to choose the next leader.
So what would you say was the one key reason then that voters decided they didn't want you in charge?
I don't think there has been one reason. I think people have lost trust in British politics. And honestly, we need to rebuild that trust.
As a result of 14 years of Conservative rule?
No, I don't think that that's the case. I think as a result of a very difficult moment that we lived. I think COVID was one of the most difficult moments that, you know, worldwide we had to go through. I think the war in Ukraine, I think the war in the Middle East, I think so many things that have happened lately that have just, you know, put the country in a challenging position.
Right. So it's external factors that's the problem as far as Sara is concerned. Zach, what do you think? Do you think there's been adequate self-reflection within your party?
I think we're definitely doing the right thing in reflecting. You know, having been at conference yesterday, there were a lot of conversations at events, but just around the convention centre between members of parliament, former members of parliament, discussing why we are where we are. And I think it's quite right that, as Sara said, we do our job as a party, as an opposition, in holding the government to account. But we have to look at ourselves internally. And I know that James has been going around the country, as indeed have all of the leadership candidates, speaking to members, speaking to voters, asking them what went wrong. And yeah, that doesn't necessarily have to be totally public and sort of external. That's something we've got to do internally as a party, as a Conservative family, from the members of parliament down to the grassroots. And I definitely think from the conversations I heard yesterday and will be taking part in over the coming days, there's plenty of reflection. And I think it's quite right. All of the leadership candidates are listening before and as part of their pitch to become the next leader.
Yeah, well, it should be, could be lively. Thank you very much to both of you. Enjoy the next day or two. That
very
is
welcome.
Zach Wagman
much.
And
Thanks.
Sara Ghezdari, both of them attending the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham. Of course, Matt Chorley will be there this afternoon, as he's been at most of the main party conferences this autumn. So you can hear him from 2 o'clock here on Five Live. It's 8:47.
Europe's elite club competition.
The Champions League.
Right here on BBC Radio 5 Live on Tuesday at 8.
Arsenal host PSG.
Right footed. This is saved by Raya. A fantastic goal save.
And on Wednesday at 8.
Aston Villa take on Bayern Munich.
Tielemans waiting. Control. Driven shot. Bottom corner.
And watch highlights of every single match with Match of the Day Wednesday night on BBC iPlayer.
The Champions League
on 5 Live.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
8:48 now in an all-British world title fight. It was Terry Harper who came out on top on Saturday in Sheffield. She beat Rhiannon Dixon on points to win the WBO lightweight crown and be a three-weight world champion. It was all across Five Live. And delighted to say that Terry joins us now. Terry, good morning.
Good morning.
Oh, man, a three-weight world champion. That's got to sound good to you. And is it something that you even thought about when you started out?
No, never in a million years. I kind of, obviously when I was younger, I came away from the sport as an amateur, and Andrew, my manager, he came over to me and I was like, what do you reckon to getting it one more shot at it as a professional? And to be honest, I just love being back boxing and doing what I love on the small hall shows, and it kind of just skyrocketed from there and my career just took off, and I was lucky to get in with Matchroom, and I've had some amazing opportunities, and Saturday night we're just cherry on top for my career,
It was brilliant. For our listeners who don't know, Terry, let them know what your job was before you started boxing.
So my job before boxing was working at Chip Shop.
You worked in the chippy.
I was university also, but yeah, I don't miss the Chip Shop days.
Well, I'm sure you don't miss the Chip Shop days, but in terms of the fight, you were so dominant. You controlled it. You landed your counters for most of the part. But Rhianna did catch you in the sixth, didn't she? How did you come through that?
Yeah, I can remember getting caught by the shot, and I was buzzed, and I could feel my legs were a little bit wobbly. And I think boxing's more like a game of poker, so I really had to not show her that she'd hurt me and buzz me, and all I could remember was thinking I've had a good five rounds and I was feeling comfortable in them rounds, so just accept that this round's not my round and just survive it, really, get my senses back and get my feet back under me. And once I went back to the corner after the sixth round and Andrew poured the freezing cold water on top of my head, it like woke me back up, and then going into round seven, it was just getting back my shape back and back to the game plan, really.
In terms of being a three-weight champion, you've been moving up and down in weight. Does lightweight feel like where you belong? Chris Lloyd, who was calling for Five Live, made a really interesting point about you now look like you are in control of your limbs. You have the power in your limbs to be able to do what you need to do in the ring.
Yeah, we jumped up that many weights just because for the opportunity and stuff. But looking back now, I do kind of wish we rebuilt at lightweight. But I guess it's trial and error, really. And I'm just glad to finally be back down at a much more comfortable weight where I'm getting in the ring, not already at a disadvantage with the weight. So I felt big and strong and, like you said, in control, probably for the first time in a long time in a fight.
Love that. And what next now for you, Terry? Who got your eye on?
For me, it's just an holiday and I'm going to relax and switch off. But I'll leave that stuff to Andrew, and when I get back in the gym, he'll tell me who I'm fighting next, no doubt. But there's loads of great fights that can be made now at lightweight, and Eddie will list them all off on Saturday night in the ring, and just it's exciting and it's nice to be back in the mix with the elite, and again, trying not to think too much about too far ahead what can happen, but I just know there's going to be great fights that'll be made.
Okay, well, Terry, you're back where you belong. Congratulations.
Thank
lightweight
you.
Champion of the world. Terry Harper there with us on Five Live Breakfast, 8:52.
Ah, Jeanette, I wish you were here with me because you'd love being in the studio right now. So Jeanette's in London, I'm in Salford, in our Salford studios. And here in the studio, I've got a family with me, George Dowell, his partner Jessica, and baby Bonnie.
Oh.
How old's Bonnie?
She's
10
months.
10 months old. She's absolutely gorgeous. And the reason that George and his family are here is because George has made this documentary all about his incredible life. He bought his childhood club, Worthing FC, after a life-changing car crash at the age of 17, left him paralysed from the chest down. He's helped transform Worthing and made a TV show about how he did it. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you for navigating all of this with a little one as well. Not quite a toddler, because she's not up and about yet, is she?
Oh, she is.
Oh, is she? Yeah. She's not on her feet walking.
Yeah, she's
taking her first few steps now.
She's really confident, keeps trying to walk from like object to object, and
Oh, yeah, give me heart attacks. Yeah,
can't take your eyes off her.
No, not for a second. That's crazy. Well, look, whatever she does in here is fine with us. It doesn't matter if she hits the microphones or toggles around or chats. Brilliant. Right, George, an extraordinary story. Football was always part of your life, wasn't it?
Yeah, a massive part of my life. That's all I can really remember from when I was, I don't know, 5 until, 17, till the day of the accident, really. All I was doing was kicking a ball around with my friends. So, yeah, it's been a massive part of my life.
And you were a player for Worthing, weren't you?
Yeah, so at 15, I went to the under-18s trials and managed to get in for Worthing. And then, I was still playing for them up until my injury.
Mm. Your injury was a car crash. I don't know how much you remember or even want to talk about that moment, but the recovery was obviously, well, I mean, what an ordeal. How can you even begin to describe it for people who haven't been through something like that themselves?
It was devastating going from being a very active teenager to overnight not being able to walk. So, it was really tough. I mean, I imagine it's tough for anyone at any age, but at 17, I didn't really have the life experience to deal with it all that well. I feel like I did okay, but I didn't really know what my life was going to be. I can comprehend what not being able to walk and being in a wheelchair would mean for the rest of my life.
And no, nobody has a mind for that kind of thing.
And at the time, you didn't hold out much hope, really.
Yeah. And you spend, inevitably, a significant period of time then in hospital. So for 10 months, you're there just basically getting the care so that you can survive and then learn to adapt your life. But I would imagine it's after that point, when you leave that kind of structured environment, that it becomes very mentally challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're in the hospital, you're kind of in a bubble of surrounded by experts and also people in a similar situation, so you feel very safe. So after that 10 months, when you do go home, kind of into the big bad world again, you've got to try and relearn everything. And I always used to struggle with going out and about and bumping into people that I knew before my injury, and now seeing them post-injury and that sort of awkward interaction where they're looking at me thinking not really knowing what to say. And so, I got in a position where I'd only go out with the same people and go to the same places just to avoid that sort of
awkwardness.
So
your life becomes smaller.
Yeah, exactly.
So it takes a huge amount of courage then to decide that actually your mission in life is to embark on a project like this to transform your club, the club that you've loved for so long, for the benefit of the whole community. What on earth led you to thinking, actually, this is my mission, this is the thing for me?
It's a good few years after my injury. I was looking for something to do. I was very aware that I didn't want to live my life like that and just being stuck in a rut and stuck at home and only doing the same thing. So after I had all my care arranged and sorted and I felt like I was in a good position, I set some money aside to effectively build a career for myself. And when it came out in the local paper that Worthing was struggling financially, I just thought, yeah, that's what I want to do with my life, really.
But this is madness. You know, you've got kind of heads of state who pile their spare cash into football clubs. This is your life savings. There must have been people who said to you, hang on a second.
Yeah, my mum being one of them. She was very keen to lay out what could go wrong. And obviously at 22, when I did buy the club, it was all I could see was, oh, this is going to be amazing. It's all going to be uphill.
22.
It was a big decision, but I knew that it was a perfect career for me because I love football so much. It was something that I was never going to quit at, and I knew that I'd always be passionate about it. So, it just made sense to me in my head. It could have gone horribly wrong, but it seems to have gone all right so far.
Tell us about some of the ups and downs, then. And I know we can't kind of get it all into a couple of minutes interview, but
So in the first summer, we laid a 3G pitch. So the whole community could come down and use it. And after about, when the rainy season started, it's meant to be an all-weather pitch. It started raining and the pitch didn't handle the rain very well and started puddling. So that took a few years to sort out. That was a stressful time, probably the biggest stress we've had. And obviously with any football club, there's ups and downs on the pitch, which the fans remind you of fairly often. So, but overall, over 9 years, it's been pretty good.
Now, when the two of you got together, Jessica, did you know what you were letting yourself in for? Not George, obviously. You knew, or you could see the kind of person he was. But the football club, the other person in this relationship.
not really. I initially saw George on The Undateables, which is a TV channel. So to be honest, I don't remember much of it now, but I had an idea of the sort of person that he was and that football was a part of his life, but in no way did I have any idea that it would be what it is, and especially what he's done now, or even how like loved he was and how well he'd done. And no, I had absolutely no idea at all. But I'm fully in there now, and yeah, I'm super proud, and I love Worthing and the team.
And I presume it's like a family project now, is it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't get too involved in the football.
Jessica's a very fair weather fan. In the early days, she'd come to all the games trying to impress, and now she only comes if the sun's out.
To be fair, she also has other distractions.
Yeah,
exactly. Now she does. Yeah,
and it's something that you talk a lot about. The wheel life is your Instagram account, so if people want to see a bit more, it's absolutely lovely. But tell us a bit about, again, some of the kind of additional things you've had to think about when it comes to having a family, given the fact that you're a wheelchair user, George. How has that all worked out?
Yeah, so the whole reason behind the wheel life really was to sort of share our relationship. Jessica used to get a lot of questions after we got together about what it's like dating someone with a disability. I get questions all the time from people with similar injuries to me saying, oh, how did you manage to have a relationship? How did you do this? How did you do that? So we just thought during COVID, when we had some free time,
because there wasn't really much out there.
Yeah.
Other than a lot of American based Instagrams, which is great. But obviously, we don't live in America, so it wasn't very helpful in some aspects. So we just thought, yeah, let's try something to put some more awareness out there.
And you post about how sort of fully involved you are in Bonnie's care. Yeah. You use a harness, so you carry around like that. You've got a special adapted feeding spoon, haven't you? Yeah. So you can help her feed.
All these tips and tricks that I feel like when I was newly injured, I would have loved to have seen someone with life experience to see, okay, this is what I can still do.
Exactly. This is what life can lead to.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's good to have that. And especially with people with lived experience. So we were very keen to set the page up answer any questions.
It's been brilliant to meet you all. Bonnie as well, Jessica and George, thanks so much. It's on TNT if people want to watch the
documentary. Tomorrow night, so 1st of October, 10:30.
And streaming on Discovery Plus.
Yeah, stream it on Discovery Plus.
Thanks so much, both.
Thank you.
Cheers.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
Nikki Campbell.
The voice of the UK.
Hey, very good morning. I hope you had a lovely weekend. So at 10 o'clock this morning, we're going to be talking Tories. Where did they go now? How did they win again? Big week for them. Big week for British politics. Big week for His Majesty's loyal opposition. Right now, talking about what one Tory said, or a debate that springs forth from it. Kemi Badenoch sparked a conversation on maternity pay. Certainly, it's a good debate to have. She said stuff. She later clarified it. Other candidates are kind of weaponizing it. More later. But right now, on all the candidates, right now, this is what she said in her clarification. Of course, maternity pay isn't excessive. No mother of three kids thinks that. But we must talk about the burden of excessive business regulation. Otherwise, we might as well be the Labour Party. Tax comes from people who are working. We are taking from one group of people, giving it to another. So there's interesting stuff in there about red tape and business regulation and all the challenges. We want to hear about all the challenges, your experiences of it. As an employee, did it give you enough support? Perhaps you or your partner is on maternity leave right now, recently gone back to work after having a baby. It would be great to hear your experience on the nation's leading phone-in, and business owners too. What's it like when a member of your staff has a baby? It can be a real challenge. Big businesses, small businesses, what are the regulations like? Are there too many? 08085 909693 and call us on 85058. What's the matter with maternity pay?
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Call free 08085 909 693. Text 85058. Text will be charged at your standard message rate. Message on WhatsApp 08085 909 693. Visit bbc.co.uk/5liveterms for our terms of use and privacy notes.